spun from the blow and went to the floor like a wet noodle. Aziz set his MP5 down and began to tear off the green fatigues he'd been wearing for the last 3 days. Rapp did a quick search of the room and came up with nothing. One by one, he pulled the canvas bags off the hostages' heads, counting 9 of them. The room reeked of urine. Whiskey 4, what's your status?
We're golden. 3 tangos down and all of the hostages are secured.
Rapp looked over at the bomb by the wall. Its red light was blinking.
We're not out of this yet. Get your boys working on these bombs.
Turning his attention back to the hostages, he said, Don't worry. Everything is going to be fine. He took his knife and cut the first 2 uniformed Secret Service officers free. Then, giving his knife to them, he told them to free the others. Rapp spoke into his headset.
Control, what's the plan?
Kennedy answered. Start moving the hostages into the tunnel. If there's no other safe way out, we'll offload them by helicopter from the roof.
Roger that.
Rapp looked back at the hostages who were still trying to get up.
Can you people move?
A couple of them nodded, and Rapp said,
All right, follow me, and don't touch anything. Those of you that can't move, I'll come back and get you.
Rapp led the first 3 out of the room and toward the hidden staircase.
Control, what's the update on Aziz?
Rapp waited, but got no reply. He repeated the question as he went back to grab a couple more hostages and was stopped cold in the hallway outside the Roosevelt room. He heard a beep and looked down at the bomb on the wall. The red light had stopped blinking and was now green. Beneath that, 2 red numbers appeared.
Shit, we've got big problems. These bombs are counting down. Control, did you hear me? Whiskey 4, did you hear me?
Rapp ran back into the Roosevelt room.
People, we have to move fast. Who needs help?
One of the remaining 6 raised his hand. Rapp snatched the Secret Service officer from the ground like a rag doll and threw him over his shoulder.
Say again? General Campbell asked. These bombs are counting down. Something went wrong. Get the Alpha team back up to the roof.
Rapp headed out of the room.
Let's go. Everyone follow me.
As Rapp raced across the hall and into the president's dining room, he yelled,
Harry, move everybody into the tunnel fast. It's our only chance.
Rapp cut through the short hallway and started down the steep stairs. When he reached the bottom, he handed the wounded Secret Service officer off to several other hostages and told Anna and Milt to head down into the tunnel and keep people moving. Rapp then ran into horsepower where he saw the first of the hostages coming his way. Rapp screamed,
Come on, people! Move! Hurry up!
The line slowed for a second, and Rapp backed up to the door and screamed,
Get your asses moving! This whole building is wired to blow!
The line instantly surged forward. Rapp checked his watch. He had no idea how much time they had left, but it couldn't be much. Harris and the other 3 SEALs finally appeared. Reavers was carrying a hostage in each arm. Clark, Rostine, and Harris appeared within seconds, each of them helping a hostage.
Is anyone else left?
No.
Harris passed Rapp and said, Get your ass in the tunnel. Rapp didn't need to be told. He was right on Harris's heels and slamming the heavy steel door closed behind him. Rapp yelled over his headset,
Milt, make sure the door on the other end is closed.
Aziz peeked around the corner to see if Benghazi was coming. The gunfire had stopped, and he took it as a bad sign. The Americans would have silenced weapons, and if he could not hear shots, that meant Raghib and Benghazi had been overpowered. The Americans would be arriving shortly. Looking at his pager, he smiled. The Americans were in for a big surprise. The pager had gone into countdown mode. The system was foolproof. He had designed and tested it himself. With the laptop jammed, the pagers didn't receive their codes. Now they were in countdown mode, and in 16 seconds they would start to blow. The green fatigues were off. Underneath them, Aziz had been wearing black coveralls similar to those worn by the FBI's hostage rescue team. The black assault vest he wore over it had FBI printed in yellow across the back. The plan was a long shot, but in the confusion created by the bombs going off, it just might work. The Secret Service MP5 submachine gun, the black gas mask he would put on once the explosions occurred, the coveralls, they would all help him blend in. Aziz looked around the corner again, expecting to see members of the hostage rescue team working their way down the hall. There was no one.
It was completely silent. He checked the pager one last time and pulled his gas mask down. The first explosion was a rumble in the distance. It was followed by a quick succession of explosions, each one getting a little louder. The building began to shake. Dust and plaster started to fall from the ceiling. The lights fluttered several times and then failed completely. All of a sudden, a huge blast came from the left where the entrance to the treasury tunnel was located. The concussion knocked Aziz to the floor where he landed on the president's unconscious secretary. Aziz pushed himself up, spitting the dust from his mouth and shaking it from his hair. His hearing had been rendered useless from the explosion. Commanding himself to get up, he stood and found the small flashlight in his assault vest. Aziz turned it on and tried to regain his sense of direction. The air was thick with dust and smoke, preventing him from seeing more than 5 feet in any direction. He was pretty sure the tunnel was to his left. Grabbing the woman, he threw her over his shoulder, picked up his gun, and felt his way along the wall for the tunnel. At the next corner, he went right, and several steps later, he stumbled over chunks of concrete that had been knocked loose from the blast. In front of him was a mound. He started to climb into the tunnel. For a moment, he was fearful the entire structure might have collapsed, but then the rubble began to dissipate. Breathing through the gas mask was difficult. It didn't give him oxygen. It just helped filter the dust and smoke from the air. Carrying the woman was proving to be more tiring than he had anticipated. He stopped for a moment to gather himself. The dust started to settle, and his breathing became slightly easier. The visibility grew better with each passing step, and it motivated him to pick up the pace. All of a sudden, he was out of the tunnel. He was immediately met by several figures wearing dark coveralls like his. Aziz did not want to have to use the weapon unless he had to. They were trying to talk to him as he continued forward, but they were not pointing their weapons at him. When Aziz was within several feet, he yelled through his gas mask, "Ambulance! I have to get her to an ambulance!" One of the men grabbed him by the arm and started to jog with him up the ramp. As they stepped out from under the covered part of the treasury garage, they were hit with the rain. The man kept trying to talk to Aziz. Finally, Aziz yelled, "I'm deaf from the explosions! I can't hear a thing!" When they reached the top of the ramp, a stream of fire trucks raced past them and onto the south grounds of the White House. Aziz turned to the left and started jogging. Dead ahead on the other side of 15th Street was where Salim was supposed to be. Emergency vehicles were lined up, their lights flashing in the pouring rain. Every second counted. Aziz pressed on. He desperately wanted to take the gas mask off, but it was too big a risk to show his face. When they reached the intersection of 15th Street and Hamilton, just a half a block away from the White House, another explosion occurred. The circular lid on the concrete trash receptacle across the street shot up in the air almost 50 feet and then came spinning back to earth. It landed with a thud in the middle of the intersection and lay smoldering in the rain. The few people that were out in the deluge were now running for cover. Aziz continued through the rain. The man that had been with him stayed behind, fearing more explosions, which, Aziz assumed, if Salim had done his job, were occurring all around the area. Aziz made it across the street and ran down the sidewalk. He couldn't take the mask any longer. It was too hard to breathe and it was fogging up. He yanked the mask up onto his forehead and took his first real breath of air in minutes. It felt incredible in his burning lungs. Aziz pressed on, looking in the windows of the ambulances for a white head of hair. As he neared the end of the row of vehicles, he began to worry that Salim had abandoned him. But there, in the last ambulance, he spotted him. Aziz ran around the back and pulled open the doors. He quickly climbed in and dropped the woman on the gurney. Before the door was shut, he yelled, "Get us the hell out of here!" Salim threw the vehicle into reverse and hit the emergency lights on the roof. He spun the wheel and yanked it into drive, stepping on the gas. The wheels spun for a moment on the rain-soaked street and then caught. Salim hit the siren as the ambulance raced forward. The police at the next intersection hustled to move the barricades just in time for the ambulance to pass through. Vice President Baxter had just finished bawling out Dallas King. Less than 30 minutes earlier, Baxter had been blindsided by the information that President Hayes was no longer out of the loop and that he himself was no longer in charge. After being humiliated like never before in his life, Baxter had gotten off the phone and started screaming at Dallas King. The vice president went into a tirade, blaming his chief of staff for the entire mess, belaboring the point that he should never have listened to a word of King's advice. King had taken the verbal beating without a fight. Secretly, he was relieved. Baxter not becoming president wouldn't end his career, but Abu Hassan making it out of the White House and telling his story to the FBI or media would. With Hayes back in charge, the odds were a raid would be ordered. King let his boss vent until there was nothing left and then turned the tables. Methodically, he made his case, pointing out that they had saved the lives of 25 people and had sacrificed what? Some money that wasn't even theirs and some sanctions that weren't even working. King stressed to Baxter that there was no way they could have played it any better. And then, in an attempt to help bolster his boss's ego, King proclaimed that history would judge his 3 days as president as some of the most difficult ever served by the nation's chief executive. That history would remember him as someone who put the lives of Americans above money and a failed foreign policy.
Remember, it ain't over till it's over.
King was building strength in his position. With each passing minute, he could see that he was getting to Baxter. King paced back and forth in front of the desk and then suddenly stopped.
This is perfect. Absolutely perfect.
What is?
Hayes may have just done you the biggest favor of his career.
King clapped his hands together.
You're off the hook, and the timing couldn't be better. So far, you've only had to deal with the little demands. Tomorrow, Aziz is going to ask for something big, and you are not going to have to be the one to say yes or no.
King was grinning ear to ear.
They are going to have to storm the White House, and Hayes is going to have to give the order.
The vice president began to see the bright side.
There just might be a way out of this.
The door to the study suddenly burst open, and one of the vice president's staffers rushed in, yelling,
"Turn on the TV! The White House is on fire!"
Baxter sprang from his chair and grabbed the remote control from his desk. The TV came on instantly. Within seconds, images of fire engines racing through the White House's gates appeared. In the background, flames could be seen shooting out of windows. Baxter turned up the volume. The anchor was saying that people on the scene were telling him that as of yet no survivors had been seen coming out of the building. As soon as the anchor said the word, "no survivors," Dallas King ushered the aide back out of the room and closed the door. The two of them stood for several minutes watching the live coverage. There were flames everywhere. Firemen were manning hoses from the ground and from the top of hook and ladder trucks. King turned to his boss, unable to hide the smile on his face.
No one is going to make it out of there alive.
All Baxter could do was shake his head. King stared at the TV for a while longer and then said,
"We need to let the media know that you are not responsible for this disaster."
King pointed to the screen.
"Hayes is responsible for this mess, and we have to make sure everyone knows that."
King felt as if he were floating on air. He was going to get away with it. Baxter looked at his chief of staff and said,
"Dallas, this is a tragedy."
"Life is a tragedy, Sherman. 30,000 people a year die in car accidents, another 100,000 from cigarettes."
King pointed to his boss.
"Now that's a real tragedy. This is not good, don't get me wrong. Some people might consider it a tragedy, but it's my job to make sure they don't think you caused it."
King picked up the phone on the boss's desk and punched in a phone number. When he got the person's voicemail, he pressed zero and got the operator on the line.
"I need to speak to Sheila Dunn immediately. Tell her Dallas King, the vice president's chief of staff, is on the line."
King was put on hold. Standing next to his boss, he watched the White House burn on the TV. In the back of his mind, he was chanting, "Burn, baby, burn."
Chapter 54. President Hayes stood in front of the White House, bathed in the early morning sunlight. Reporters shouted questions from beyond the fence line, and he ignored them. The important thing was that the nation see he was alive and well. He would make a formal speech in the evening and explain the tragic events of the last 4 days. Special Agent Jack Warch stood at his side along with a half dozen other Secret Service agents, all of them wearing sunglasses. President Hayes held his hand over his eyes and gazed up at the proud old building, amazed she was still standing. FBI agents were sifting through the carnage, collecting evidence. Virtually all of the windows were blown out, and there were holes punched in the stone exterior where the bombs had exploded. Fortunately, the fire had not burned uncontrolled. Between the heavy downpour and the firefighters, the blaze had been kept in check and was prevented from engulfing the structure. Priceless national treasures had been damaged beyond repair and lost forever, but the important thing was that the hostages were alive. Jack Warch reached out and tapped the president on the arm. President Hayes looked down at his watch and nodded. The troop then moved out across the lawn for the northwest gate. The president looked to Warch and said, "I bet your wife and kids were happy to see you this morning." Warch smiled.
"Yep. Lots of hugs and kisses."
Hayes grinned and slapped Warch on the back as they crossed Pennsylvania Avenue. Several large limousines were parked in the street. One of them, Hayes recognized, belonged to the vice president. The entourage walked up the steps of Blair House, where a U.S. Marine opened the door for the president and saluted. Hayes returned the salute and entered the foyer of his new home. Several reporters from the White House press pool were inside with their notepads ready. The president paused to take a look around and pronounced, "If it was good enough for Harry Truman, it's good enough for me." The reporters laughed and wrote down the quote. The president's chief of staff appeared from the parlor and said, "Everybody's here, Mr. President." Hayes tugged on his white shirt sleeves and entered the room with Warch and Jones. All of the attendees stood, some more enthusiastically than others. The president had called the meeting several hours earlier and had put together the list carefully. Stansfield, Kennedy, Flood, and Campbell were all seated on one of the room's two large couches. Sitting across from them was Vice President Baxter and Dallas King. Despite the extra room on the couch, Anna Reilly and Milt Adams had chosen to stand. The president walked to the front of the room and looked at the only two people he didn't know.
"I'm looking forward to meeting both of you, but we have some business to take care of first."
Hayes looked around the room for a second, and then to Director Stansfield. "We're missing someone."
"He'll be along shortly, Mr. President."
Hayes nodded and brought his hands together in a tight grip.
"All right, let's get down to business. First things first." Hayes's gaze fell on Dallas King. "We are going to set the record straight, and we're going to make things right. Dallas, I've been told you made quite an ass out of yourself over the last several days." Hayes paused. "Anything you would like to say in your defense?"
King shifted uncomfortably on the couch and was rapidly trying to think of a defense when the parlor doors opened and in stepped Mitch Rapp. Rapp walked across the room to where Reilly and Adams were standing.
"I'm sorry I'm late, Mr. President."
"That's quite all right, Mr. Cruz. We were just getting ready to hear Dallas King explain his behavior over the last several days."
King was sweating bullets. The president extended his hand, and Valerie Jones deposited a copy of the Washington Post in it. Hayes held it up for everyone to see. The headlines read, "President Hayes orders failed raid." Hayes handed the copy back to Jones and said,
"The Post rushed to press with this story last night and wound up with a lot of egg on their face this morning. I won't even get into the specifics of the article, other than to say that almost all of it is false."
Hayes watched King for a moment.
"Dallas, do you have any idea how the Post came up with a headline like this?"
At first, King only shrugged and then muttered some unintelligible words. Inside, he was relieved. For a moment, he had thought Hayes had found out about his late-night tour of the White House.
Let me see if I can refresh your memory. Hayes extended his hand, and this time Stansfield placed several documents in it. I have phone records here showing that someone called the post last night from the vice president's house. I have other records showing that over the last several days, someone has been calling a reporter at the post from your mobile phone and your home phone. Hayes held the phone records up for all to see. King squirmed on the couch and looked to his boss for support. He got none. Afraid to look the president in the eye, he answered with great discomfort,
I made them.
I thought so. Hayes handed the phone records back to Stansfield and turned to Jones. She handed him a folder and a pen. Hayes crossed over to King and dropped the pen and folder in his lap. We took the liberty of typing your resignation for you. Sign both copies and keep one for yourself. Hayes watched King sign the two sheets and took one of them back. You may leave now. It was silent as the vice president's chief of staff got up to leave. King was more relieved than any of the others in the room could know. He could handle a quiet resignation. The truth, however, would ruin him. Hayes turned his attention next to Vice President Baxter.
How do you like foreign travel, Sherman?
Baxter looked up at Hayes and said nothing. Hayes went on. I hope you like it a lot, because for the next 3 years I'm going to send you to every third world country I can think of. The president turned and walked to the front of the room. It was obvious to all that he was trying to keep his temper in check. You have set our foreign policy and national security back a decade. I would fire you if I could, but the harsh truth is that I can't. So I'm stuck with you for the rest of the term, and then, Sherman, as everyone in this room is my witness, you will choose not to run. Hayes's cheeks were flushed. For good measure, he added, Don't press me on this, or I swear to God I'll have Director Stansfield start leaking your CIA file to the media. Now get out of here and keep your mouth shut. Hayes pointed to the door. When the door was closed, Director Stansfield looked around and said,
Mr. President, I don't have a file on the Vice President.
Hayes winked and said, I know that, but he doesn't. The President grabbed a glass of water and took a sip. Turning back to the group, he said,
I can't thank all of you enough for the job you did. It was truly unbelievable.
I'm going to start with you, Mr. Adams. Hayes walked over and shook his hand. I am indebted to you for what you did. The risks you took when you clearly didn't have to get involved speak volumes about your character.
Adams was uncomfortable with all of the praise.
I was just doing my duty, Mr. President.
Hayes grabbed his shoulder and squeezed. We need more people like you, Milt. If there is anything I can do for you, just let me know, and I will take care of it.
There is one thing that I can think of, sir.
What's that?
This retirement thing isn't all it's cracked up to be, and I was thinking that since your house is in dire need of repair, I might come back and help supervise the rebuilding.
Absolutely. That's a great idea, Milt. I will have it taken care of immediately. Anything else?
Nope.
Well then, Valerie will walk you to the door and get all of the information. I can't thank you enough. Adams finished shaking the president's hand and turned to Reilly. Milt reached out and kissed her on the cheek.
Watch out for this guy here.
Adams let go and shook Rapp's hand.
Well, Mr. Secret Agent Man, I suppose this is the last I'll see of you.
You never know. Rapp pulled Adams over and gave him a hug. I'll make it a point to stop by and see you.
Yeah, you do that. Just don't come asking me to join you for any more crazy missions. I'm too old for this stuff.
Adams started for the door and turned back.
You two make a cute couple. Maybe you should stop by some night and I'll make you dinner.
We'll have to do that. Rapp turned to Reilly and laughed. After Adams left, the president focused his attention on Reilly.
Young lady, your first day at the White House turned out to be a doozy.
Yes, you could say that.
Are you going to stay on, or has this experience soured you?
Stay on?
At the White House.
Of course.
Good. Hayes smiled. I asked you here this morning for two reasons. The first was to thank you for all of your help. I've been told you played a crucial role in helping Mr. Cruz here pull this thing off.
A very small one.
Really blushed. Well, thank you. Your sacrifice is very much appreciated. Hayes looked over at Rapp for a second, and then back to Reilly. Can you guess what the second reason is? Reilly folded her arms across her chest.
You wanted to talk to me about how much of my story I plan on telling.
She intentionally chose the word my. Precisely, Hayes backed up a bit. How many reporters do you think have witnessed an exchange between the president and the vice president like the one you just witnessed here this morning?
Probably none.
That's right. Hayes gestured to the four people sitting on the couch. These four fine individuals think I should pressure you into signing a bunch of documents that will bind you legally from publishing anything we think a threat to certain security interests. But I have assured them that there is a better way to handle this. Hayes paused to give Reilly a moment to reflect on the first option. Walking back to the front of the room, he continued, "The other way, the better way, is for you and I to make a deal." Hayes raised his eyebrows. "In exchange for your voluntary cooperation in regard to keeping certain aspects of the most recent events secret, I will give you a head start on certain events of importance." Reilly could hardly believe she was even in this meeting, let alone receiving such an offer from the president. She told herself to play it cool and asked, "What types of things will you want to censor from my story?" Hayes looked to the four on the couch. Kennedy spoke first. "If you leave out Mr. Cruz and any direct involvement by the CIA, we're fine."
"Am I all right if I say you were involved in intelligence gathering and planning?"
"As long as you stay vague, we won't have a problem." Reilly raised a skeptical eyebrow.
"Define vague."
Hayes stepped forward and waved his hands in the air. "Hold on, I have a better idea. Ms. Reilly, how would you like to get the scoop on a huge part of this story?" Hayes looked her in the eye. "At noon, FBI Director Roach is going to hold a press conference and the cat will be out of the bag. I can give you that story right now, and you can head out to NBC and break it to the world. You will scoop everybody." Reilly was interested, very interested. This could turn out to be a nice arrangement. She nodded and said,
"I'll play ball."
"Good. Here's the deal. The FBI has searched the White House, and they can't find one of the terrorists. We have reports that last night after the explosion, someone from the FBI carried a wounded woman out of the Treasury tunnel. That woman turned out to be my secretary. She was found in a ditch in rural Maryland at 6 this morning, barely conscious. She was last seen with Aziz right before the explosions took place outside of my bunker." The president paused, giving Reilly a second to pull it together. "Oh, and one other thing. There were no FBI agents in the building when the bombs went off." Reilly's eyes got big.
"So, you're saying Aziz escaped?"
"It looks that way." Reilly looked to Rapp, who reluctantly nodded. After shaking her head, she said,
"Wow."
Hayes walked over and placed his hand on her shoulder. "I'm serious about our arrangement." The president turned her toward the door and started walking with her. "You've earned this, Anna. Thank you for everything you've done." Reilly didn't know what to say. She didn't feel as if she had done all that much.
"Thank you, sir."
"No, thank you." Smiling, Hayes squeezed both of her shoulders. "I almost forgot. I have one other thing for you. Director Tracy of the Secret Service is expecting a call from you. It appears he has some information on Dallas King that you might find interesting. Now, if you'll excuse us, we need to discuss certain things involving Mr. Aziz. Stop by next week, and we'll talk more." Hayes turned Reilly out the door and opened it for her. Rapp sat watching the exchange, and as Reilly left the room, he felt a sinking feeling in his stomach. He wanted to talk to her. With a frown, Rapp looked back across the room. President Hayes came walking back toward the fireplace, saying, "I don't care who we have to bribe, who we have to threaten. I want Aziz's head on a silver platter. I want him taken out,
and I want us to seriously explore our options for dealing with Saddam Hussein.
Hayes turned to Rapp. I can't thank you enough. This country can't thank you enough.
The president shook his head. It's a shame they'll never know the contributions and sacrifices you've made.
Rapp grinned. That's all right, sir. I didn't exactly get into this line of work for accolades and recognition.
I know you didn't, but I just wish there was a better way to repay you and properly show our gratitude.
Just let me be the one to punch Aziz's ticket, and that'll be payment enough.
I plan on it, which brings me to my next point.
Hayes looked away from Rapp for a second and focused on the others.
I want every intelligence asset we can spare focusing on tracking down Aziz. Call in every marker we have. As I said a second ago, we are not going to play by the rules on this one. I want him caught.
Hayes turned back to Rapp.
I want you to go home, and I want you to get some rest.
The president began to walk Rapp toward the door.
If we find him, I want you fresh.
Yes, sir.
Rapp shook the president's hand and left the room. He walked out onto the front stoop of Blair House. Bringing his hand up over his eyes, he shielded them from the light and searched the crowd. Nothing. He turned to his right and left, but came up empty again.
Can I help you find something, Mr. Cruz?
Rapp looked down. Directly in front of him, leaning against the president's limo, was the beautiful Anna Reilly. Rapp walked down the steps and said,
I thought you'd be hustling off to your station to break the story.
Reilly pushed herself away from the limo. With a grin, she said, I have some time. Reaching her hand out, she added,
Besides, I wanted to say goodbye.
She grabbed Rapp's hand and squeezed it tight. Pointing down the street, she said,
Why don't you walk me down to the corner so I can catch a cab?
Sure.
The two of them started walking toward 17th Street, hand in hand. Reilly leaned away from him and asked,
So, are you ever going to tell me your real name?
Maybe.
Rapp took a couple more steps and smiled. Someday, after you earn my trust. They walked in silence for a while, and then Reilly asked,
So, about this life story of yours, when am I going to get a chance to hear it?
Whenever you want.
I'd imagine you're going to be pretty busy for a while.
Who knows?
They reached the corner and stopped.
I'm thinking of taking some time off.
Really?
Why do you sound so surprised?
Reilly studied him for a second.
You don't seem like the type of person that takes time off.
Rapp shrugged his shoulders.
You'd be surprised.
I think there are probably a lot of things about you that might surprise me.
Rapp shook his head.
I doubt it. I'm pretty boring when it comes down to it.
Reilly looked down at her hands and rubbed her thumb along his finger. Peeking up at him, she said,
We need to set our dinner date.
Her thumb rubbing up and down his finger made his heart race.
Any time you can fit me into your schedule.
How about sometime next week?
I was thinking about something a little earlier.
Reilly looked up with her green eyes, a soft smile spreading across her face. Rapp reached down and grabbed her chin. Pulling his mouth to hers, he kissed her and said, How about tonight? Epilogue. The old man shuffled down the busy street. It was almost midnight, and the crowds were thinning. He picked his way through the people, his posture hunched, his eyes scanning their faces. He wore a pair of dirty, cracked tennis shoes, and his jeans were several inches too short. Matted clumps of dirty gray and black hair adorned his head, and a film of dirt covered every inch of exposed skin. In some cities he might have stood out, but not in Sao Paulo, Brazil. With over 20 million people, 5 million of whom lived in utter poverty, he was just another lost soul. He stepped past a fellow homeless person who had curled up in a storefront doorway for the night. He was in Bom Retiro, the ethnic enclave of the massive city that was home to almost 1 million Palestinian, Lebanese, Iranian, and Arab immigrants.
His arrival in this city, of all the cities in the world, was a feat in and of itself. It had been prompted by one small piece of information. Muttering in semi-conscious delirium, Farah Harut had unwittingly given them their clue. Within minutes, a massive electronic gathering operation by the National Security Agency was underway. A KH-12 keyhole satellite was moved into geosynchronous orbit over the city of Sao Paulo and began recording phone conversations from the Bom Retiro neighborhood. The NSA's supercomputers at Fort Meade, Maryland, sifted through the thousands of calls and kicked out the ones that matched pre-assigned profiles for content, tone, and voice signature. It had taken 3 weeks and a day, but the analysts finally found what they were looking for. The old man continued weaving his way through the crowd, his dirty canvas bag draped over his shoulder. He marked the faces of the people he had seen on his previous visits. He looked at their eyes and checked their waists for the telltale bulge of a weapon. That was how he had found this street the night before last. It started with one man standing in a doorway smoking a cigarette. He had shifted his weight from one foot to the other, and when his unzipped leather jacket opened, it revealed the black steel of a pistol. Rafiq Aziz was near. Rap could feel it. When he passed the man standing guard in the doorway, he kept his head down and looked the man over closely. A few steps later, Rap stopped and bent over to pick up a bottle cap he had dropped on a previous pass. When he stood, he looked through the small crack at the bottom of the window shade and spied two men sitting on a couch watching TV. 20 minutes earlier, Rap had watched a sedan pull up in front of the row house and deposit a prostitute. Rap continued down the street and turned into the alley. He pulled the top off a garbage can and pretended to go through it. 50 feet away in the darkness of the alley, the hot red tip of a cigarette glowed. Rap had been adamant about one thing. He would go in alone. No contact with the Brazilian authorities, no electronic surveillance vans, and no hit squads. Nothing to spook Aziz into running. Commander Harris and 12 of his SEALs were on station, waiting in two sedans a mile to the east and two more to the west. Rapp had convinced his bosses and the president to give him a week. It had taken just 3 days for his trained eyes to discover what all the expensive surveillance equipment in the CIA's arsenal would have missed. The simple bulge on a man's hip. With each passing garbage can, the alley grew darker and the rats more plentiful. Rapp threw a bottle in his canvas bag and looked up at the second story of the house. The shade glowed a soft yellow as a candle flickered behind it. A figure briefly moved in front of the shade. Rapp licked away the dryness on his lips and felt his heart quicken as he neared the back door. The bodyguard was only 20 feet away, and Rapp could feel the man watching him. Glancing to the side, he looked for the guard's hands. One was resting on his right hip, and the other on the butt end of the cigarette. Rapp stepped carefully. He was close now, just under 10 feet away. He heard the guard's pistol slide out of its holster and kept about his business. The guard spoke to him in Arabic, telling him to move on. Rapp looked up and acted as if he didn't understand the man. His hand was still in the worn canvas bag, a firm grasp on the familiar grip of his silenced Beretta 9mm pistol. Rapp looked at the barrel of the guard's pistol. It was pointed at the far end of the alley. Wrong move, Rapp thought to himself as he squeezed the trigger of the Beretta. A single bullet spat from the end of the gun and hit the guard between his thick black eyebrows. Rapp rushed the next 3 steps, grabbed onto the falling man, and eased him to the ground. From his bag, he pulled out a small radio and said, "I'm entering the house." Leaving the bag next to the body, he slowly stepped into the kitchen. There was laughter from down the hall, and voices could be heard from the TV. Rapp closed the door behind him and crossed the kitchen. Straight ahead and down the hall was the front door. To his left, the stairs that led to the second floor, and to his right, the two men watching TV with their backs to him. Every second counted. Rapp stepped into the room and leveled his Beretta. The man on the left sensed something and spun around. Rapp immediately connected the face with a name. It was Salim Roussan, the man who had stood on the roof of the Washington Hotel a month earlier and killed a dozen Secret Service officers. Rapp put a bullet in the back of the second man's head, then hit a surprised Roussan between the eyes. The silencer barely made a noise. Rapp stepped to the dead man on the right and took the remote control from his hand. After turning up the volume on the TV, he started for the stairs. In his radio, he whispered, "Three tangos down," proceeding to second floor. He checked the stairs quickly and then started up them two at a time. Stopping just short of the top, he listened. From the door straight ahead and to the left came the passionate purrs of a young woman moaning. Rapp took a deep breath. It had come down to this. He grabbed the doorknob with his right hand and pushed. Rapp rushed the room, his gun sweeping from left to right. To the right was motion, two bodies intertwined, lying flat. An arm extended above both heads, reaching for something. Rapp took aim and fired. The bullet slammed into Aziz's elbow, shattering the joint. Rapp did not hesitate. He moved his gun in an effort to find a more vital target. The woman was in the way, and Aziz was rolling to use her as a shield. Rapp found Aziz's hip, fired his weapon, and started to close. The second arm was now reaching for the pillow. Rapp hit him in the other elbow. Blood geysered from the fresh wound, and Aziz let out a low, guttural moan. Rapp yanked the woman off the bed. He took off his wig and spat out his fake teeth. He looked down at Aziz, lying on the bed and bleeding in three places, his arms useless. With the silencer pointed at Aziz's forehead, Rapp asked, "Do you remember me?" Aziz looked up in pain, no recognition on his face. Rapp turned his head to the side. "You cut me in Paris, remember?" Aziz's face froze as he searched his memory. After a moment, a thin smile creased his lips. Rapp backed up a step. With great satisfaction, he squeezed the trigger one more time, closing a very bad chapter in his life. "Four tangos down. I'm on my way out," Rapp muttered into his radio. He herded the prostitute down the hall and to the first floor. At the back door, he told her to get lost and watched her stumble into the darkness. Rapp reached into his bag and grabbed a block of C4 plastique, setting the timer for 20 seconds. He threw it into the kitchen and closed the door. Rapp walked casually to the end of the alley where a 4-door Mercedes sedan skidded to a halt. The back door flew open, and Rapp got in next to Commander Harris. As the driver hit the gas, there was a loud explosion, and the dark alley erupted into a fiery ball.
You've been listening to Transfer of Power by Vince Flynn, read by Nick Sullivan. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.